My name is Gary Haverland, and today is November 16, 2011. I am interviewing for the first time George McFarland, and this interview is taking place at the McFarland property on Big Prairie. This interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the North Fork History Project. When did you come to the North Fork for the first time, and why?
Well, my parents were... They purchased the other Fenton homestead on Big Prairie about 1942, and then they ran some cattle and hired two men that stayed there, and I don't quite recall what year I came up. There was a lot of state land inside the park at that time, and there was a small prairie south of the Bulbridge Ranger Station, and we got a lease to cut hay on it. And I remember helping to put up hay maybe about 1944. Y'all are saying that's the first recollection I have, and then the family came up in the summertime about 1946, and then these first winter they stayed over was about 1947 there. So that's my first recollection of the area there.
You remember about how old you were?
No, I was a teenage years, but I...
Uh-huh. What are some of the earliest memories that you have of the North Fork?
Yeah, I eventually had a dude ranch, so I wound up taking people out on a 2 or 3 hour or horseback rides. And then in the summer, we put up hay on the main ranch, and maybe like all teenage people that look back, the summers went on and on forever. They seemed like they were a good 4 months long. But we... I spent a lot of time tripping up hay, and we had a big haystack, and we also had a big barn that I had a special cable outfit that they could, with the big tongs, they could take hold of a stack of hay and hoist it up into the barn there.
So mostly you had a lot of work to do.
Yes.
And I'm here today with Jan Caldwell, and I should let him ask you a question or two. Number four is...
Yeah, what was the North Fork like as you remember it?
Yeah, I remember going down to the Pulbridge store, and it was still operated by a Bill Adair, and to get gas, there was a pump on the front porch with a large glass window, and for how many gallons you wanted, Bill would operate a big handle, and then the gas would come up to 1 gallon, 2 gallon, 3 gallon in there. Then I remember one time that Matt Brill came down, and he and his wife operated the dude ranch up at Trail Creek. So those were some of the old timers I didn't speak to, but just had met real briefly there.
I'll go ahead and do number four, too, George. As you think back to that period, what other North Fork residents made an impression on you?
Well, he had Scotty Beaton, who was on Numa Lookout. He had just sort of retired shortly after I had, you know, our family had moved here. He had the distinction of being up on Numa for 20 years and not having reported a false fire and not having missed a fire. He retired with a special commendation from the Park Service. And then he would come over and we had a lot of ditches to dig and things, and he would come over and work, and then sometimes us boys would ski over to his place in the winter time. He had a small homestead set up on Akakola Creek. And then right behind the ranger station, there was another homestead that by an elderly man with the name of Henry Covey, and then his nephew, who was just a few years younger than he was, just Bemis, was they lived on that homestead, and they had a couple of horses, and they raised rabbits for food. And that's all I can think of the elderly homesteaders there. Mm-hmm.
Did you know many of the people on the other side of the river?
Yes, knew Madge that had the place, the homestead, almost on the border, and she had three or four husbands, and we met the last husband. He came down in the middle of winter. He snowshoed down, and he was a French Canadian beaver trapper. And I then, of course, knew Lloyd and Ruth Saunderson quite well, and would get snowed in the winter time. My dad had a small Ford tractor, but when the snow would drift in so he couldn't push it with a small tractor, Lloyd and Ruth would come over, and then Ruth would Lloyd would plow out the road and widen it a lot, so from our place down to the ranger station, so then my dad would be able to, that would usually be in end of February, and then my dad would be able to keep it open again with the Ford tractor. And briefly knew the acquaintance of a number of the residences, but the names I can't recall off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next question is, what was the daily life like, and how was it different from life in most parts of the country? And
all I can think of that is that the families that lived up here, they just worked from dawn till dark, in summer and winter. They didn't have as much relaxing time as a people have up here now.
As we do now.
Did most of them raise cattle or other animals?
Yes, a lot of them raised the cattle, and they all, and then a lot of them had big gardens, and they worked awfully hard on their gardens.
And I was going to ask you, you said you were snowed in. You must have homeschooled up here?
Yes.
From what grades?
Yeah, the only thing I recall is that my mother actually had a teaching credential, but she just really hated the homeschooling. That's all I have to say on it.
Okay. Tell us about the North Fork social life.
Dad thought that people needed to get together more, so he with a number of other people, they organized the North Fork Improvement Association, and then they would meet once a month at our place, and this is the summertime, and my dad was the first president, and I think Walt Hammer was the second president they had, and then after the meeting there, they'd have a square dance, and they had a man and his wife called Hunt, and Hunt played the violin, and his wife played the piano, and then there would get a third man that would call, and the square dances often they'd break at midnight to eat and then go on until about 1:30 in the morning, and then after a number of years they built the community hall and Larry Wilson doesn't talk about in his column, but where Saunderson Hall is, that land was donated by Madge, donated the land for the hall, and then there would alternate, but most of the meetings were held over there, and then in the summertime, 1 week they'd have square dances over there, and then in the alternate week they'd have the square dances would be held at our place.
At the Quarter Circle Guest Ranch, I remember.
Mm-hmm. Some of the first early dances were held up at Matt Brill's place after he had sold that at his lodge up there, and then the lodge burned down.
Yeah, I remember some of the good times myself. Were you a member of any organization on the North Fork?
Well, my parents were, of course, members of the North Fork Improvement Association.
Number 10 is a two-part question. What were the modes of transportation in the North Fork? And the second part is, what was the North Fork Road like?
What people don't realize today is that the old Inside Park Road, that was the main route up the North Fork, and that was the route that the mail was designated to come on. And I think that was up to about 1958 or something. That was the way that most people drove up, and the Forest Service Road from the was very rough, and a friend of mine marked it all during the mid-1950s. There was grass growing in the middle of the road, and then at some point in the 1950s, the Forest Service started to work on the road, and then eventually by 1960, it became the route of the route of a choice, and then they changed the mail contract to come up from Columbia Falls on that road. Mm-hmm.
Did it cross Pole Bridge at that time and go up the other side of the river?
Yes, when the mail came up the park side, it would cross over Pole Bridge and then stopped at the store, and then of course there was a regular post office at the store, and then it would go on up to Trail Creek. Somebody in the Trail Creek area would take the post office up there, and it changed around from the various people.
How did you communicate with other people on the North Fork?
There was a phone. There was a phone from the ranger station at Kentland Lake that ran all the way down for the people at Big Prairie, and then went down to the ranger station at Pole Bridge, and then went on down the inside road to the park headquarters, and then there was a phone line that that went down the Forest Service side, and I'm not sure whether it went to Columbia Falls, but it did also kind of come over. We went to the store, I think, and then came over to the ranger station at Pole Bridge, so the ranger station at Pole Bridge could talk to people up on the Forest Service line, and then I know that phone went on the Forest Service side. It went as far as Walt Hammer's place, and might have gone even up to Trail Creek, and at some point. I think in the 1950s, the Forest Service just yanked it out without asking anybody about it. My mother, in the wintertime, the ranger's wife, who was at the Pole Bridge ranger station, would call up my mother when the both women were very bored with midwinter, and she'd say, "Mary, you want to hear an interesting conversation?" And then she would plug my mother into a conversation going on between two women on the Forest Service side.
And those were the old Forest Service crank phones.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Everybody was on a party line.
Yeah, yes.
Do you remember what your ring, like it was one long and two shorts or something like that?
Yeah, there were three of us kids in the family and two adults, and whether it was just a pure happenstance, we were two longs and three shorts. And then the Pole Bridge Ranger Station was two longs, and they had the two adults there, and then I don't know what the in Kettler Lake, the phone ran all the way up to Numa Lookout, and Scotty Beaton was, of course, as I mentioned, just a super alert person, and we had a small hot water heater on our place that one afternoon caught fire, and we rushed up there to try to put it out, and then my dad rushed for the phone to call for the fire engine they had at the ranger station, and he just picked up the phone and he heard Scotty Beaton talking to the ranger, and Scotty Beaton said, "There's a fire at McFarland's place, I think between the third and the fourth cabin." And then they got their Dodge World War II surplus fire engine going, and the carburetor was plugged up and could only come up at about a mile and a half an hour. And they, of course, arrived after we had the fire completely out for about a half hour.
Had the fire out before the truck got here.
Yes.
Okay, I can do 12.
Yeah, number 12 is, what did you do for fun?
Yeah, I've been trying to think that over. I think that we had bought a number of World War II life rafts, and I think other people in the area did, and started to float the North Fork was recreation. I remember one time, I think some people came up from the ranger station, and my dad and them tried to float it in March, and they got down about a mile and a half, and then it was iced up. It was a warm spring, and they thought it would be open, and they could float all the way down to the ranger station. But I think the life rafts, and then I think a number of local people took boats up to Bowman Lake and the Kettle Lake, and had small outboard motors. And then there was a good lake to fish. Used to be a Quartz Lake, and various people would go in there, and us on horseback or hike into there.
I remember you mentioned earlier that you took people out on horseback when you were out here at the Dude Ranch. After you got done doing that, did you ever just go for a ride on your own and just do some exploring?
Well, I always, I wanted, personally, maybe ahead of my time, I wanted to, I was interested in mountain climbing, and the park it had on the east side, it had quite extensive mountain climbing, and they had guides in the 1920s at Mini Glacier, but then in the era we first came into here, that the park just didn't want anybody to climb mountains, and they really discouraged it. There was one ranger naturalist on the east side who was just a natural born mountain climber, and he began to mimeograph descriptions of how to climb the peaks in the park, and he sent one to every ranger station, and some ranger stations just put his mimeograph booklet in the waste paper basket, and then the local ranger station gave me the mimeograph, and so yeah, so that was my recreation was trying to attempt to climb some of the local mountains here.
Somebody had mentioned to me that you tried, or maybe you actually made it up to Numa Peak, up above the lookout. Did you ever go clear to the top?
Yeah. It's a wild place, yes.
Do you have any idea about how old you were when you did that?
I was probably around 19. I was able, I had a, by happenstance, on difficult mountains, I was able to get somebody who knew a lot more than I did about. And on Numa, a friend of a friend came by, and he was the president of the Princeton Mountaineering Club in his last year, and he was about 6'4" with tremendous arms and a very skilled climber. And we'd climbed another mountain the year before and had some happenstantial things, so you only got 3/4 of the way up.
Okay. You also climbed Rainbow Peak, didn't you?
Yes. That's is no complications on the peak. There's a number of routes you can take up the peak there. Probably the most direct, everybody tries to find different routes or works out different routes, but probably the best and most direct route is there's supposed to be even a trail from the lake now up on the right-hand side of this stream bed there that takes you up right a ways, but you sort of aim for the saddle between Rainbow and Square Peak, but the steepest of everything is the grass slope that goes up to the saddle there, just the last. It's about 500 feet or so of grass, but it's just very steep, and there's some rocks interspersed with it. But you just want to be very careful, and it's just slick bare grass, and so you just don't want to fall, or you go heads over heels and hit one of the rocks, so you just need to be just very cautious and plant your feet on the top side of the bare grass there. But it's a long day, and for ordinary hikers, you leave the lakeshore at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and then you take a little bit of rest at the saddle there, and then hour rest on top. But you don't usually get back to the lake till 9 or 10 o'clock, just at dusk there. And so my only advice is to just get an early start. You gotta leave the foot of the lake at 4 o'clock in the morning, so you get up to the stream bed that drains Square Peak and Rainbow. You're up there at 5 o'clock in the morning to start going up, and then you have to be also watchful, because there's grizzly bears on the They're on the face and the backside of the rainbow, and so you want to keep, once you leave the size of the saddle between Square Peak and Rainbow, you just want to scan the slope constantly for grizzly bears. Some people have gotten within 400 feet of the top and run into a grizzly bear and then have to come back down.
Have to turn around and go back.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about any major forest fires, the old forest fires maybe, floods or ice storms or other major events that you experienced on North Fork?
Well, I was gone when the 64 flood came. And I don't... we didn't have any big... we had no big fires until recent years.
But did the Red Bench fire get fairly close to this area right here in Big Prairie?
Yes, it crossed at the south of the just at the south of the prairie is where it crossed. I can remember talking to the local ranger in the 1950s that every at these ridges we can see from Big Prairie, there's ridges from Bowman Lake that come down, and then ridges from Quartz, and then I don't think we can quite see it. Ridges come down from Logging Lake, and the fires were any lightning fire. We had a lot of dry years with no with lightning, with no rain. In recent years, in the last 3 years here, 2009, 10, 11, we've had lightning storms with lots and lots of rain with them. But back in the early 1950s, we had just so many dry lightning storms, but the on these ridges, they're very hard to get to where the lightning fires were, and so they drop are the smoke jumpers, and then so every single fire that occurred was ruthlessly suppressed, and then right from where we can see on Big Prairie, I forget exactly the year, but sort of the 1970s, the area was just getting choked with lodgepole, and the trees were getting stressed, and then the stressed trees invite the lodgepole beetle to come, and then we could look up on the hillside and see all this brown from all of the lodgepole that had been killed by the beetle, and then it spread from here and went down to whitefish, and some might have, I don't know what, and spread out of various places in the Flathead, all from right coming out of the North Fork area here. And then, by when the Red Bench came in 1988, we had a lot of down beetle kill trees and also standing beetle kill trees. And they said when the fire hit those trees, and they had some wind behind it, but they moved it up to a 16 miles an hour, which is one of the fastest rates that forest fires have been clocked at.
What are some of the other events that happened on the North Fork that you remember?
you probably recall better than I do all those other fires. There was a Moose Fire, and then in much more recent times, the Wedge Fire that was very large. But I think long before my time, the big fire was 1929, and that started down by Half Moon, a ways in north of where the Blue Moon is, and there's various theories of how that got started, but anyway, that blew over to Tea Kettle Mountain, and then went up to North Fork, almost to the Canadian border, and then one arm of it and came over Huckleberry Mountain into Apgar, and then went down and just bypassed park headquarters and then split, and one arm of it went up the Middle Fork Canyon, and another arm went down to towards Hungry Horse and Corum. And they said for the North Fork, as the fire was coming, the people just dug big holes in the property and buried all their furniture, and then got wet gunny sacks and got in the middle of the river with wet gunny sacks over them as the fire went by. But these are just what I've heard from other people, and it would be good. I don't know if you could interview people. I don't know how old they'd be by now, but it would be good to get some first-hand interviews or second-hand interviews, because that was the big major event up here. And then the larch, there was all this standing dead larch, and that was cut. Local mills cut that, and that was a premium wood for flooring. When my family was building a house in Whitefish, fire kill larch was what was the flooring that everybody wanted to have. And then in those larch rills still standing, I think up to the 70s to 80s or something here.
Excuse me. What were some of the leaders or characters? There were some real characters on the North Fork. Do you remember any of them?
No. We all that you have to get from people on the other side. There was a lot of the North Fork in the 20s and 30s just had a maybe about average for the state at that time, but it just had a lot of people who didn't get along with each other. And the superintendent of schools in Whitefish, he came out from Minnesota as a young man, and he came out in 1926, I think. And he said, up the North Fork in 1929, there were three people shot in the wintertime over several months' time. And he said the sheriff didn't want to, no way was he going to snowshoe up here in the middle of winter. So the county coroner just put opposite each of these people were shot. He put, he wrote in the logbook, a justified homicide is what he wrote next to all three names.
Saved him a long trip coming up here.
Yes. But that was my dad's feeling, that the North Fork Improvement Association would get people together and talking, and bring more harmony to the area. We did have, because we ran a dude ranch, we had to, we were dependent on our mail. The secretary of the Dude Ranchers Association, and he was in Billings, and he would get inquiries for dude ranch vacations in midwinter, and then depending on what type of place they want, he'd send inquiries to those ranches that might answer the people's questions. So we were really dependent on our mail, and the Holcombs, longtime, almost original people on the North Fork, their daughter married a man called Ralph Day, who was one of the laziest people on the earth, and he got the mail contract, and you're required to have it, your mail contract, to have a vehicle that wouldn't go over the snow. In the late 1930s, a man that had a homestead called Lion was his name, and he had a Model T Ford that he put skis on front and then had rigged up tracks on the back, and it was a real going snow machine. But when Ralph Day took over the contract, all he had was a Jeep, and he would try to start out from West Glacier and get bogged down, and then he'd say he made an attempt, and then they'd give him the pay for the week. And so my dad, we were just dependent on the mail to come, and so my dad would file complaints with the post office department, and then half the people up here, they wanted mail, but the other half supported Ralph Day, and finally they would put pressure on him, and I know one time Lloyd Saunderson rigged up a big sled and built sort of a cabin on this sled, and then there was Ralph Day would bring the mail up with his cat, that he put expensive to run a cat all the way to Trail Creek, but they did that under pressure when they hadn't gotten nobody had gotten mail for a month or so. So we were not in good stead with a number of the North Fork people because of the mail situation. But eventually my dad bought a real small airplane so he could fly into West Glacier and pick up our mail, and then occasionally would pick up other people's mail locally too. And then about 1952, we moved down to Arizona for the winter time, and would get letters down there saying, "We're up the North Fork and we're not getting mail. Can you help us with our mail service?"
That's funny. Do you remember, George, how you celebrated holidays?
Well, the big one was the 4th of July, and they had, the standard was a fish fry. Everybody would go out, and a number of people would go out and try to catch a lot of fish, and then they'd start to fry them up, and then they'd have a baseball game, and then they'd eat the fish, and then they'd have a square dance. That was always the big thing, and a close friend of mine just said it always had rained on the 4th, and wouldn't last too long, but every 4th of July would have a rain shower.
In the 4th of July parade here in the last few years, you've been in it with your grandkids, haven't you?
No, well, that's Jack.
Oh, that's Jack that brings, gets all the kids organized.
Yeah,
because I've seen them in the parade.
Yeah.
That was always kind of fun.
What was Christmas and Thanksgiving like?
And the Thanksgiving, I mean, remember we would invite Scotty over, and then the homesteaders that lived behind the ranger station would come over, and then on Christmas, I just remember one Christmas that my parents had ordered presents, and then the mail didn't come, and so my mother gave my dad a pair of socks he didn't know he owned, and my dad gave her a can of varnish for snowshoes.
Tell us about any close encounters you had with wild animals.
Did have one close encounter with a grizzly bear on Rainbow Peak there. And then there was a man by the name of Jim Bond here in about 1950. He was a biologist from Oregon, and he was hired by the Yukon government to go up and go into an area where nobody had white people hadn't much gone into there, and he found it was very rich in minerals and calcium things, and he found in there moose with gigantic horns, and he had put together a paperback book, and then he had a movie he toured the country with, and then it just wound up my dad was able to see the movie and talk to him and invite him up to the ranch in the spring for a couple of days. But in the movie, he shows how the Indians up in this area could attract moose. They'd find a shoulder blade of a moose, and then they'd rub that against some willows, and it would sound like another moose was getting his horns all polished up to fight, and that, and the other moose would come right over and investigate. I always like to explore around on foot, and one time in the middle of summer, I was going back through all this lodgepole, and I looked down, and here was a shoulder blade of a moose or an elk, and I picked it up, and I said, well, probably won't make not much noise on jack pine here, so I rubbed it against the jack pine, and it made sounded really amplified sound. I was really surprised, and then suddenly I heard something moving, and some big animal came about 50 feet away from where, just charging through all this jack pine. I have never picked up a shoulder blade since. I had another time just walking back here. There's all through this country here, there's a lot of places that a small creek, and then the beaver dammed it up and created a pond, and then eventually the beaver would move on and the pond would dry up, and then if it had a lot of trees, you'd have dead trees that would be where the pond was, like matchsticks. And one time I just walked into the one of these dried up ponds, and but to get across it, all these windfalls, and so I started stepping across each one and stepping, and then I was about two-thirds of the way across this pond, and I stopped and looked up, and here 15 feet in front of me was a cow moose, and she'd never made any, it just stood there and watched me come up to her. So the only thing I needed to do was turn around and step over all these lodge poles and go back.
Get out of there.
I have seen some mountain lions, and not very often, but once every 5 years or so, we would see mountain lions. And
what's your advice if someone runs into a grizzly? When you mentioned up on Rainbow Peak, how'd you handle that?
Well, that's what the old-time local ranger had. It's a lot of good sense. He'd say, if you run into a grizzly, said, I can't tell you what to do, but if you can come back and tell me the story, you did the right thing.
That's good advice.
Well, the thing is, wherever you're walking, make a lot of noise, just noise, and then I take the bear spray. Is very important. There's so many problems about the bear spray trying to get it out of the holster. You can fire some of them right on the hip there, but you got to get the safety off and everything. And if I get charged, I think I'd be all thumbs and never be able to get it out. A number of years ago, there was a young woman hiking and got charged by a bear, and she got her bear spray out and pulled the trigger, but it was pointed the wrong way, and she sprayed herself, and she just screamed a huge loud scream, and the grizzly stopped in his tracks and ran off. The first and foremost thing that's very hard to get across with people, if you have a camera, forget about it. Do not try to attempt to take a picture when you meet up with a grizzly. You want to communicate to the grizzly that you don't mean harm, and you need a lot of unconscious things deep in your psyche to try to communicate this. And the camera will just get you into trouble, and not to communicate this. We have the problem when hiking along, if we don't make noise, if it's a mother grizzly with young, they're afraid of a male grizzly, they're being attacked by a male grizzly, which will try to kill the young. And so they're very just very alert for anything that's trying to sneak up on them, and then usually they come unglued. But the male grizzlies also, it's deep in their genes that anything that's sneaking up on them is just bad news. And then we walk along upright, which in grizzly language, grizzlies stand up a lot to get a better view, but standing upright in grizzly language is aggressive posturing. And then we got a backpack on our back, and that means the grizzly interprets this as a hare standing up on our back, which is another aggressive posturing, and then we stare at them, which is also aggressiveness in bear language, and then we bring up the big lens, the big eye, and point it at them, and that's being super aggressive. And so we communicate all the long things when we meet the bear. With grizzlies, if everything else goes wrong, I just play dead. Some of the manuals say to interlace your fingers over your neck, but if you play guitar, you want to protect your guitar fingers. But you want to very be sure that it's a grizzly, because you definitely do not play dead with mountain lion or play dead with black bear. That's the problem there. Mm-hmm. But the grizzly thinks we're a member of the grizzly clan. And so when you play dead, it's an unwritten thing of animal clans. You don't maim or kill a member of your own species. And so they'll usually, if you play dead, they just give us a couple of bites to put us out of a commission, and usually they don't go in too far, an inch and a half. They could snap off a whole leg or a whole arm without anything, but they just that's just something that they don't do. So for sure, it's a grizzly. Under play dead, will look out, and very, very definitely do not try to climb a tree. Our local ranger Jerry DeSanto was pulled out of a tree. Breaking off the limbs is a very aggressive sound in grizzly language, and the adult grizzly can't climb trees, but they haven't read the wildlife manual. So they can come right up a tree after you. They're not supposed to be able to do it, but they can get up fast up the tree and then reach up and yank you out of the tree. Hmm. But the biggest thing is just making noise and not taking bears by surprise.
That sounds like really good advice, George. Believe it or not, we're down to the last question. What kinds of changes have you seen over time?
Well, here on the park, on the road to, halfway on the road to Bowman Lake and road to Kentler Lake, I've seen much, just a new type of driver, of driving small cars very aggressively. And I've talked to the local ranger about it, and I said, is this my imagination, that people are just driving aggressively in the last couple of years? And he says, no, it's not your imagination. The maintenance man who collects the garbage from Bowman Lake and Kentler Lake, he used to have a a two-wheel drive pickup with a long bed, and every spring the park orders a whole fleet of new pickup trucks, and then depending what you do, you can pick out the pickup truck you need, and it's probably been about 4 or 5 years now, but that I met the maintenance man on his way up to Kentwell Lake, and I just started staring at his pickup truck, and he had a short bed, and all this garbage he has to pick up at Kentwell, there just didn't seem space for it, and then he saw me staring at this short bed, and he turned to me and he said, I know it's short, but I can dodge these people a lot better with this truck. And then in real tight corners downhill, I had cars just trying to pass me, coming the other way. And I just get mad, and I held up my hand and got them to stop. And I said, you just need to go slow here. And they just exploded me. Just said, I know this road. I've been driving this for years. I know how to drive. Always meeting park trucks as forever and ever, as they just basically driving too fast. The National Park Service, of all the government departments, it has, it's supposed to have the worst record for driving in accidents. And the trucks used to be orange, and then they painted them green, and you couldn't see them coming, and now, thank goodness, they're going back to orange again.
Oh, they are.
Yes. Not... A couple of years I was gone, bouncing around the country, working in other places, and left my pickup truck with my mother here, and she was taking some friends up to Bowman Lake for a picnic, and I got back the next spring. She said, George, there's some scratches on your pickup truck, and turned out that the maintenance man, who was actually a good friend of my mother's, they met him coming down the Bowman Lake Road as they were going up, and he was driving the big garbage truck, and he got and so my mother was pulled off, but he stopped, and he tried to pass her, but he misjudged it and put two dents, big long scratches across the door, and then he got wedged in, and I had to back up, and then he put two higher scratches across the door, but I thought it was humorous. David, he was a real nice man, a good friend, but this was and I had just 2 years ago, I was crossing the road right to the ranger station, the Bowman Lake Bridge, and a big, huge gravel truck, and I had pulled off, and it was just crossing the bridge, and it just trying to roar past me, and I got my hand out, and I got him stopped, and I just said, you need to go slow. I said, 50 years of bad driving on this road. I was so mad, I filed a complaint with the ranger, but this year, they've been doing a lot of work on the Bowman Road, particularly up towards Kentland, and when you meet one of the big gravel trucks, they often stop, and they pull off and stop, and boy, that's a real change.
Yeah. That's good.